We're going to go ahead and call this meeting of the Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. And for the record, we do have a quorum. First thing on the agenda is minutes from St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. Representative Kraft, have you had a minute to look at the minutes?
I have. I move their approval.
Great. Questions or comments about the minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And we've got three bills on the agenda today. First up, we have Representative Buck in House File 4236. We'll let you work your way to the testifier table. Mr. Wyckoff, you can, sir, or Commissioner, you can go have a seat too. Do you want to go ahead and move your bill, Representative Buck?
Yes, I would like to move my bill 4236 to be laid over.
Great. Then why don't you take some time and please tell us about your bill.
Wiotaha Sampo Washte. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. I want to say, Padama Yayapi, thank you for giving me the opportunity to present House File 4236. Minnesotans are facing rising energy costs due to aging infrastructure, increasing demand, volatile fuel costs, and lost federal subsidies due to H.R. 1. Placing a cap on interim rate increases will reduce ratepayer burden by preventing unnecessary overpayments. And with that, I will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff to walk through this bill for you.
Welcome back to committee. Commissioner Wyckoff, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Aikum, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the interim rate bill. This comes to you with support from both Commerce, and you'll hear in a few minutes from the Public Utilities Commission as well. My name is Pete Wyckoff. I am Deputy Commissioner for Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. When I drive through my city, there's one price of energy that I see prominently. It is big and right there on the sign. X dollars and cents for 1 gallon of gas. And this week, those signs are making me think about purchasing an all-electric car, to be honest. But that's not my point today. This is my point. If I don't like the price I see, I have options. And that is how a market usually works. The owner of the gas station wants to make a profit, but to do that, they need customers. If I see the price one place and I don't like it, I can easily comparison shop. And as I begin to get older, I talk about the price of gas at gas stations more and more, about what station A is charging versus station B versus station C. And that really annoys my kids. But I'm also helping the market work. The gas station owners need to cover their costs, and they are entitled to make as much profit as the market will bear. But the presence of competitors and customers willing to seek out the best deal or to just bike or take the bus keeps them honest. That is not how the natural gas and electricity system works in Minnesota. The majority of us are captive customers of regulated for-profit monopolies. There is no market to keep them honest. Instead, that job falls to Commerce and other interveners, with the Public Utilities Commission serving as judge and jury. When the regulated for-profit utilities need to up their rates, they make a proposal for what the new rates should be. They get their proposed rate as an interim rate, and your bill goes up right away. Meanwhile, we do careful evaluation of what kind of rate increase is fair and justified. When that evaluation, called a rate case, is complete, the actual new rates are set. If the new approved rates are lower than what the utility asked for, which they almost always are, by a lot, then customers are refunded the extra that they had been charged during the period of interim rates. Here's the problem. What that means is you and I gave that for-profit company a loan. We were not asked if we wanted to give them a loan. We were forced to do it. And while that for-profit company has access to capital markets that can loan it money at low interest rates, you and I might not be so lucky. We may be forced to put that money for that artificially high gas or electric bill on our high-interest credit cards. Or we may just fall further behind on bills that we can't afford to pay at all. That can end in shutoffs and even an eviction. What this bill does is simple and long overdue. It will cap interim rate increases at no more than 5% while a utility's rate case is under review. Utilities may need some additional revenue during that process, but under our current system, they are automatically granted interim rate increases based entirely on what they request, using a generic formula that involves no analysis, no vetting of costs, and no vetting of the verification of the need for the funds. As a result, interim rate increases are routinely substantially higher than what regulators ultimately approve. In fact, if we look back 20 years, interim rate increases for major Minnesota utilities have, on average, been twice as high as finally approved rates. This pattern has real consequences. Utilities will argue that high interim rates are needed to maintain investment, but the department notes that the most large infrastructure investments, including major generation and transmission, are already recovered through riders outside the rate case process. This significantly minimizes any risk to investment from capping interim rates. According to the data the department has reviewed, we can confirm that Xcel has over-requested $179 million over the past 7 years, not including its current electric rate case. That includes 3 gas rate cases and 4 for electric. Minnesota Power customers were overcharged by $126.9 million over 4 cases. Otter Tail Power customers were overcharged by $22.9 million over the past 4 rate cases. The bill before this committee offers a balanced solution. It recognizes utilities may require some additional revenues during a rate case, but it protects Minnesotans from excessive unsubstantiated charges that have become routine. It ensures families, seniors, and small businesses are not forced to shoulder inflated bills for nearly a year while utilities collect revenue above what they can justify. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to return for questions.
Great. And you can just even stay seated if you'd like, Commissioner. There's several other testifiers. First up is Mike Bull with the Public Utilities Commission. Welcome back to committee, Mr. Bull. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mike Bull. I'm the Deputy Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. We appreciate Representative Buck and the Minnesota Department of Commerce bringing HF 4236 forward, reforming Minnesota's interim rate statute, as you heard from Deputy Wyckoff. In this time of focus on affordability, the Commission is increasingly concerned about interim rates. And as noted by the Department of Commerce, Minnesota's interim rate statute allows rate-regulated utilities to increase rates according to a formula and statute within 60 days of filing a rate case without analysis by the parties or approval by the Commission. And the amount of increase can be substantial, and as Dr. Wyckoff just mentioned, generally much higher than the final rates approved by the Commission. We've seen rate increases under the statutory formula of 14.2%, 9.4%, 11.3%. These are representative of what we see under that formula in the statute. And again, these interim rate increases go into effect without analysis by the parties and without approval by the Commission. And as you've just heard, if the amount approved by the Commission in final rates is lower than the amount collected by the utility, as it often is under interim rates, the difference is then refunded to utility ratepayers with interest. But this does constitute a forced low-interest loan from ratepayers to the utility during the pendency of the rate case. For these reasons, we support interim rate reform this session and urge your support for House File 4236.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Next on the list, we have Eric Lipman with Utility Reform Now. Welcome back to committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Eric Lipman of Utility Reform Now. Representative Buck is certainly right about one thing, which is ratepayers are burdened, and they're burdened by overpayments. But in my view, House File 4236, while well-intentioned, is at best an interim solution on the problem of interim rates. She's right about the problem of unforeseeable spikes in utility rates, what folks who are in the utility industry call rate shock, and it is shocking. But the underlying core problems are different. The problems that underlie rate shock are twofold, in my view. One is that the process for setting rates is too costly and too lengthy. There are a number of letters in the materials now about that. And the other key piece is that it does nearly nothing. Our current process does nearly nothing to produce gradual increases in rates, the kinds of things that Representative Buck would like to happen, and me too. The handout includes two potential solutions as you move towards possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. They're fairly straightforward, both of which would, I think, incentivize better outcomes by casting more sunshine onto the problem areas. And I think there are two. The first suggestion is to disclose the amounts that the government will charge ratepayers for setting rates. In Xcel's current rate case, for example, the government charges are going to be 6% of the increase. I think if we're sending out notices, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to put those inserts into the mailers, we should disclose what the government is going to be adding on to those bills. I think it's basic transparency. The other is much more important. I think gets to the key issue. It's to jumpstart the development of gradually inclining multi-year rates. And in this context, I think it's important to remind members who the Minnesota mother of multi-year rates was. Anyone want to guess? Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman. And while I know, and I certainly support the efforts, there are lots of efforts around the Capitol to name a park after her, to name the building across the street after her, I think much better than those efforts, although those are certainly fine, is to rescue her work in multi-year rate plans. She broke the logjam of the 2015 special session by reaching across the aisle to Pat Garofalo. They made House File 1, to give us multi-year rate plans. But it's been stuck in a regulatory desert at the PUC for 10 years. Call them to account. Jumpstart the problem. A more lasting solution than the interim solution presented today by Representative Buck. I think if you rescue what she did in her life, that's a much better tribute and testimony, and it's much better than a sign. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
I just want to say, thank you, sorry. I just want to say for the record, I was right twice, he said. Just for the record.
I'll give you a sign, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joe Hoppe with Otter Tail Power, for the record. Otter Tail Power is one of the smallest investor-owned utilities in the nation. We generate, transmit, and distribute electricity to approximately 133,000 customers in 422 small communities across 70,000 miles in Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. I'm speaking today in gentle opposition to House File 4236, the legislation that would cap the interim rates at 5%. At Otter Tail Power, we try hard to hold off on rate cases as long as possible. Part of the reason for that is that rate cases are expensive, and we have a smaller customer base to whom we can spread the costs of a rate case. Limiting interim rate increases will likely result in more frequent rate case filings for Otter Tail, and thus greater costs to our customers overall. Historically, we have been about 5 years between rate cases in Minnesota. Should this legislation pass, it's likely that we would have to increase the frequency of rate cases, depending, of course, on the level of deficiency. As a regulated utility, our rates are based on our costs. That means what causes rates to increase is inflation that impacts our costs, borrowing costs that change, or we're installing infrastructure that benefits services to our customers. Limiting our ability to increase rates needs to be tied to our ability to control those cost changes, many of which are beyond our control. While we are open to having conversations with legislators, with the Department of Commerce, and with the PUC regarding the whole process of how rates are set, we don't feel that House File 4236 is the right way to go and would respectfully ask that the bill not move forward. Madam Chair and committee members, Representative Buck, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hoppe. Next on the list, we have Jennifer Cady with Elites and Minnesota Power. Welcome to committee. Thanks for making the trip down. Please go ahead, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Acom, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Cady. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and External Affairs for Elite and Minnesota Power. Thank you to the committee for the great work that you all do. Thank you, Representative Buck and Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff, for bringing forward this important discussion today. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about a business model that means a lot to me personally, and I think does something remarkable that other business models don't do, which is to balance private investment for public good by maximizing the efficiencies of what both government and business can bring to the table to deliver an essential service to Minnesotans. Electric utilities that are regulated are different than gas stations in that we cannot just change the price of our product based on the inputs. We have to go through a lengthy regulatory process, which includes robust public input and many public hearings before we can change the price of our product. As a capital-intensive business, we make investments in large infrastructure projects that serve customers for decades, and our regulated business model has served our state well, with investors providing upfront capital for infrastructure to guarantee safe, reliable, and affordable electric service for all of our customers. The utility can only recoup its costs that have been spent through cost recovery proceedings like rate cases. And after rate cases are concluded, customers slowly pay for that infrastructure over the decades of its useful life. These investments don't often match neatly with a benchmark like that of inflation. They also don't match the volatile worldwide supply chain disruptions or seismic shifts in trade barriers. Instead, investments are made simply when the system needs them. Minnesota Power does not ask for more than what we need to operate the business when we file a rate case. We know that we have customers that are sensitive to any price increases, whether they be our residential customers or our largest industrial ones. There have been times in our history when we haven't requested a rate case for years, sometimes up to a decade, in part because we know the regulatory framework would fairly evaluate the merits of our request when we brought it forward. And while Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff is right that a lot of major investments do get covered through cost recovery riders, I would argue that our most valuable asset, which is our people, is what's covered in rate cases. Current law allows utilities to collect interim rates for certain costs while the rate case undergoes a lengthy regulatory process, and customers do receive refunds with interest if final rates are determined to be lower than interim rates. An arbitrary cap on interim rates like today's bill requires may have some short-term cost savings, but with longer-term unexpected implications. For example, the impact of the bill will likely drive more frequent rate cases, as Mr. Hoppe just described. We'll be unable to stay out of rate cases for longer periods of time as we have in the past as we look to try to minimize the loss of cost recovery. Additionally, rating agencies review and grade credit risk based on the financial risk of a company. They focus on how constructive the regulatory climate is and metrics like cash flow to total debt. Rating agencies have long considered interim rates a positive tool to maintain financial ratios, and a change to the current process would impact those ratios and potentially those ratings. Today, Minnesota is the fifth lowest state for electric rates in our country. That statistic signals that our regulatory framework is working well. There are many things we can and should do to address energy affordability. In fact, you heard from my colleague, Mr. Martin, just a few weeks ago about Minnesota Power's state-leading affordability programs for customers. As utilities, we are being asked to make more investments into our system faster than ever, and we believe the current regulatory model in place serves our customers well by delicately balancing sustainability, reliability, and affordability. Thank you so much, Chair Acom.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Al Krug with XL Energy. Welcome to committee. Please make yourself seated and introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Al Krug. I am Associate Vice President for state and regulatory policy for XL Energy. The company cannot support House File 4236 since we do not believe that it effectively addresses affordability and may have unintended consequences for both the company and our customers. At the outset, I note that XL Energy has worked diligently in the face of rising costs of operation to maintain affordability for our customers. We have also provided tools for our customers to use energy wisely and efficiently so as to mitigate the impacts of rising costs. And we've also worked collaboratively with stakeholders to develop tools for addressing the needs of our at-risk customers. By capping interim rates at an arbitrary level, the proposed bill does not make energy more affordable. Rather, at best, it delays for a brief period the period of time the rate increases required by utilities to maintain safe and reliable service. Ultimately, this cap will have no impact on the near or long-term cost of energy, as rates will be set based on the Commission's final determination of the rate increase they deem appropriate. As I mentioned at the outset, an arbitrary cap may also have unintended consequences that it will have negative impacts for both the utilities and our customers. First, by capping interim rates, utilities may find it necessary to file for rate increases more frequently, as cost recovery may lag rate increases, putting additional pressure to file sequential cases. Second, utilities may be unable to agree to extended periods of time for rate review, which we typically have done in proceedings in Minnesota, which will provide less time for our regulators to evaluate our requests. Finally, investors may view caps on interim rates as inherently riskier than the existing process, causing utilities to acquire needed capital at higher costs of debt and equity, ultimately translating into higher rates for our customers. In conclusion, XL Energy does not support the proposed bill, but stands ready to work with stakeholders to keep the vital services we provide affordable for our customers, particularly for those less able to afford these services. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Krug. And last on our list of testifiers, we have Eric Swanson. Welcome to committee, Mr. Swanson. Please go ahead, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members, Representative Buck. Eric Swanson, I'm a shareholder with Winthrop and Weinstein and testifying today on behalf of CenterPoint Energy. By way of very brief background, I have been involved in Minnesota rate cases, the vast majority of Minnesota rate cases, for, I dare say, the past almost 40 years now. Doesn't seem possible, but it's true. Originally representing Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff's agency, then the Department of Public Service, now part of the Department of Commerce, then I represented residential and small business customers for the Attorney General's office, and for the past 25 plus years, I've had a variety of clients in my time at Winthrop and Weinstein, including utilities. So it's a process I know all too well. House File 4236 certainly appears simple, one sentence added into the statutes, but as you've already heard, this one sentence could have some unintended consequences. I don't want to repeat what has already been said, but briefly, I do want to discuss again why the interim rate statute was put into effect. It's been on the books since 1982. We think it's served both utilities and customers over that time. Second, how they work. Just a few additional nuances I think are important for the committee to understand as you're considering reforms. And then I'll just summarize concerns I think that have already been voiced about why changing this process now could actually do as much or more harm than good. Throughout Minnesota's utility statutes, the legislature has made sure that this is a process that's designed to balance interests, balance the interests of the utilities and the utilities' customers. And with respect to rate making in particular, since 1982, the legislature has seen the merits of a system that establishes essentially a hold harmless policy from the customer's perspective with respect to interim rates. It's necessary because this process is long. It can take 14 to 19 months from the date of filing to the date of implementation of final rates. And from the utility's perspective, what interim rates does is allow timely recovery of their prudently incurred costs. While that case is going on, the utility spending funds that aren't currently being recovered in rates. Interim rates recognizes that, allows the utility some of that recovery. It's also viewed as a positive, as you heard from Ms. Katie, by credit rating agencies. From the customer's perspective, you ensured fairness in this process by establishing a one-way true-up at the end of the day. If interim rates exceeded final rates, there is a refund with interest, not with nominal interest, with interest, and I'll talk more about that. But if the interim rates did not fully recover, the utility doesn't get to go back and charge. That's a reasonable process. I talked about interest. I think it's important to understand that, for example, in CenterPoint Energy's last rate case, CenterPoint paid 8.24% interest on its refund, which amounted to a one-time refund of less than $5 per customer, including that 8.24% interest. To give you a couple other examples, three rate cases ago now, the refund was higher. It was about $15, a one-time $15 refund to customers. Two rate cases ago, there was no refund for residential customers because final rates were actually higher than interim rates. Again, we think it's a balanced process. We think it's a process that has worked well. It does not allow full recovery of the utility's request. Interim rates are often significantly less than the full utility's request. What utilities are allowed to recover are any previously approved costs, the items that the commission has said, yes, that's just and reasonable to include in rates, not allowed to include costs that are different in nature and kind, and not allowed to increase return on equity. So, again, it's a balanced process. We think it's worked well. I had marked three possible unintended consequences that have already been testified to by others, so I think I'll skip that. But those consequences are real, and we don't think they're good for utilities, for customers in the long term, or for stakeholders. As Mr. Krug mentioned, one of the benefits of interim rates is it does allow the utility some flexibility in the timing of the case, with the knowledge that they're recovering their just and reasonable costs as the case grinds on through the process. So we think it's a process that's worked well and doesn't need to be changed at this point. We are very interested, though, in full discussions on what new, better programs can be developed for affordability, for administrative efficiency. With respect, we just don't see House File 4236 as advancing those causes.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. That's the end of our testifiers today, so thank you to all of them. I have a quick question before I turn it over to our committee members for conversation and questions and comments. My question was going to be, and maybe got partially answered, but Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff, I'm curious if there are examples when, and I think Mr. Swanson alluded to, interim rates that are lower and they, as he described, can't charge us. So does that have a kind of backsided impact to aim high in interim rates? Commissioner Wyckoff.
So I will, Chair Ekam, I will start by saying that that situation is extremely rare. And I will say that from the data I have seen, CenterPoint, compared to the other regulated utilities, comes in with more honest requests. For the other requests, we are reducing them through the process by an average of 50%. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't happen that we make an error in the other direction, at least not in the last 20 years, which is what my folks looked at.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. First on the list is Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if someone can tell me how interest rates are set for these things. When a utility has to pay back How are interest rates determined? Does anyone know?
Looks like maybe Mr. Bull is coming forward with some information. Welcome back. Go ahead, Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kraft, the amount, the interest rate is set by in Minnesota rule. And specifically, it's Minnesota Rule 7825.3500, which specifies that it's the we're to charge the average prime interest rate, which right now is about 6.75%.
Okay.
Right. Any follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. if I'm remembering my finance correctly, and that prime is something that banks lend to each other, and if a company is going to get a loan, they're generally going to be at something more than prime. I don't know if you all can respond, or maybe even,
Commissioner, you know, Mr. Bull?
Actually, it's okay. Mr. Swanson seems to be chomping at the bit, but I'm gonna have a question for him too. So
great.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
And yeah, so I imagine that 8.24 was at a high time of higher inflation as well.
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely it was. Prime at this, the way the interest rate calculation works is you go month by month, the period in which the interim rates have been in effect, and you match up the prime rate each month with that. So at the start of CenterPoint's last case, we were seeing prime at 8.5%. It's now down, as Mr. Bull said, to 6.75% currently. But as far as the utility financing and the debt that the utilities carry on their books, it's at a significantly lower percentage than that. Long-term debt rates are typically now in the fours, and short-term can vary all over the place. Well, we're still benefiting. These are long-term investments. We're still benefiting from very, very low interest rates pre-COVID.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my question for you is, if that interest rate was 50% that you had to pay back to ratepayers, or 100%, would that change what you do?
Mr. Swanson.
If the interest rate were 50%, there'd be some very interesting legal challenges to the ability of the state to require that payment. That's a hypothetical. Hypothetical that doesn't.
It's a thought experiment.
Doesn't make sense.
But if it were, right? If we were allowed to do that, you would not use the loan from the end customer, from the ratepayer. You would go to some other way to get the money that you need in the interim. Would you not?
With respect, we don't use interim rates as a loan from ratepayers now. Interim rates are paying the ongoing cost of service as the case is proceeding.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So I get that you don't call it a loan. But there's a lot of stuff being thrown out here about unintended consequences and all that. When you strip all of that away, I think this has been really, because I'm learning here. I think what is happening is that the utility gets to go in and say, we want this amount of money. No one can say no, right? And then at the end, we'll pay the person that's giving us this extra money back with interest that's lower than what they would get somewhere else. And even if it wasn't, by the way, even if it wasn't, then you're saying, if you're saying your cost of capital would be lower outside, well, then go get it there because you'd save money that way. So if we strip all of this stuff away, like I get that you have this cushion that provides cash flow, right? If there was a better way of providing cash flow, if you could get that far less than what you're getting by the cash flow from ratepayers, as a business, you would do it. So, I mean, stripping all this stuff away, it's just dollars and cents. So I think what's being proposed here is just saying, hey, let's, instead of being on the side of the large corporation, let's be on the side of the ratepayer. I think that, I mean, I you know, you strip all this away. Yeah, it's, you know, if you had a better way of getting cash flow operating funds, wouldn't you do it?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the utility can always go out and take out more debt or try to raise more capital, but that comes with a cost as well. And to your point of, I mean, I think it's important to understand, again, it's not that the utility gets to ask and gets to recover. It is, interim rates are approved by the commission. It's, we don't just get to put them into effect. It is, albeit a largely statutory formula, but it's costs that have already been approved by the commission in the past. If costs, if the utility is now seeking recovery of costs that once were denied by the commission, we don't get to include those in interim rates. If the utility is looking to increase its return on equity for shareholders, we don't get to include that in interim rates. And at the end of the day, as I said in CenterPoint's last case, for example, it was an average refund of $5. And that reflected 8.24%. And I don't know anywhere that a customer could have gotten 8.24% for a 14-month loan.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so perhaps I should have one of the other utilities up there, because it sounds like you all are keeping things really tight. But still, again, if this is being done on a larger scale, right, bigger numbers, if what you're saying is, you know what, our cost of capital is 4%, how much we could get a loan for is 4%, and we're going to pay the ratepayers 8%, well, you could then lower costs by getting it elsewhere. So I think we're not going to go any further on this, but so I'm done. Thank you.
Great. And thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Representative Swazinski. Or Chair Swazinski, sorry.
Sorry, I do that all the time to you. So, Mr. Bowl, could you come up for a sec? Thanks. Mr. Bowl, you said in your testimony that, you know, at times the utilities would ask for maybe a 14% or 9.2% rate of recovery or whatever that would be. What was the final number that they came to after that?
I have that written down.
He's going to go get his notes. Mr. Bull, when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Swazinski, in the case of the 14.2% interim rate, the final rate that the commission approved was a 9% increase. So the refund was provided there. That was a Minnesota Power 2021 rate case. XL in 2021 also had an interim rate increase under the formula of 9.4%. Final rates were came in at a 3% increase.
What was that?
9.4 is an interim rate, and then 3% as a final rate. And then in Otter Tail Power's 2026 case, the amount of interim rate increase was 11.3%. Final rates, that rate case is still pending, so we don't know what the final outcome.
Representative Swazinski.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. So, then my question would be to Mr. Wyckoff. So in the state of, so if the bill were to move forward in that 14.2% and it wound up at 9%, how much would that save ratepayers if this bill was in law and we said, you know, you can't charge 14.2%, but you can only charge 5%, but then the rate case came up to an increase to 9%, how much would that save ratepayers?
Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff.
Chairs, so this and Acom. I can't do that math, and I don't have the spreadsheet in front of me to come up with a direct answer. But I can tell you that my analyst said that over the last three rate cases, XL Gas customers would have saved $45. XL Electric customers would have saved $26. MP, Minnesota Power customers would have saved $85. And Otter Tail would have saved $70.
Okay. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you,
Chair
Madam,
Swazinski.
Madam Chair. Mr. Wyckoff, over what period of time?
Those are over the last rate cases, looking back three or four rate cases in each case.
Thank you,
Representative.
Madam. Mr. Wyckoff, how long did those rate cases take?
You're okay.
Chairs, Swazinski and Akam. Rate cases, we ideally take less than 12 months. In reality, they can take over a year.
Okay.
Chair Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wyckoff, so on average, what do you, you know, we'd like to them be under the year, but on average, they're over a year. Is there any numbers that could be talked about, maybe with someone on how long they've been waiting for their rate case to be approved? Mr. Bull?
No, thank you. I would like to know the answer to that, too. I don't have that in my head.
Okay. Well, we could move on from there. You know, so that's, you know, from the testimony, it seems like, you know, so even within this conversation, it was stated earlier that right now there is a current mechanism so that if the interim rates are higher than what they would have potentially been, that there is already a system in which for utilities then to repay that or to, you know, count that as credit to future bills that ratepayers would pay. But there potentially is not a mechanism then if the rates, so if we arbitrarily set them as a legislature at 5%, regardless of a formula, like in the case of that 14.2 that went to 9, there would be a separation of 4% that I'm not sure how that would potentially go. And so while we talk about, you know, whether it's $42 over a rate case, that's over up to a year, 18 months to 24 months. When it came to a rate case, we're talking about $45 or $70. You know, there are other things that we can also do. And while I appreciate, you know, this exercise in communication and talking about it, you know, what are our real goals, right? Is it to legitimately talk about what can save ratepayers real dollars? What can we do to shrink the period of time in which it comes to get rate paces, you know, through the system and approved or disproved? And what are we doing to cost drive the cost of energy up as a legislature? Like, I appreciate that we get to split hairs on this, but, you know, for some bills, it might be community solar. You know, how much is community solar costing ratepayers from a fuel surcharge above and beyond what utility solar would be? You know, that's a conversation worth having. What other mandates are we placing on? You know, look at the cost of property taxes that is being hoisted upon utilities. You know, these are monopolies that are operating under the jurisdiction of the PUC to some extent. And then we are, as a legislature, going back and then charging them property tax. Well, there's no one else to compete against, and we're raising the cost through property tax or regulatory issues. You know, those are all costs that at the end of the day are going to get bore down by utility rate payers. And over 10 or 15 years, that could be literally billions and billions of dollars. And I think that's, I appreciate this. I appreciate this conversation. And we talked a lot about, Mr. Wyckoff, you began your testimony talking about, you know, let's let the market decide. Well, there are a lot of areas that we could allow the market to decide, and we could get out of the way. And I think that's the argument that's fair, but then let's do it across the board.
And I'm not seeing further questions or Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just kind of going along the same lines, you know, how did you come up with 5%? This is a question for Mr. Wyckoff, just if there's a guide that you saw that 5% looked good to you as far as that cap before you for all this stuff happens.
Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff.
Chair Akam, Representative. So 5% comes from two places. One, 5% is about the average actual rate increase over the period of rate cases we looked at. And two, if there's a set amount that a utility can get and they know that in advance in terms of that interim rate increase, then they can plan to it by how long they're going to stay out, what expenses they make that go into that rate case. So they should be able to plan to that 5%.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So along with that, as long as we're talking about, you know, that, then we've kind of had an idea of what that cost. What's your expectation of what it costs for the administrative differences? Mr. Swanson said, you know, the efficiencies are have some value. So what's your assessment of that? If folks have to spend longer times or more often doing it, what's the cost to ratepayers for this administrative efficiencies?
Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff.
Chair Ickham, I don't have all of the costs, and Representative, all of the costs for everything involved in a rate case, because I only know what Commerce does. But I can tell you over our last four rate cases, we have spent on average $200,000 of staff and contracted Attorney General office time. So $200,000 per rate cases. These are cases involving tens to hundreds of millions of dollars.
Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the dollar amount I'm looking for is not what you came up with for cost. I'm looking at what 12 to 24 months for the providers of electricity have for cost, because that actually would become part of the ratepayers' cost, because you don't just eat all of those. There's a cost to doing business. So we're talking on one side, that's a cost to doing business. That's the way they're deciding for free markets to use that money. But no one's anticipating what the cost to ratepayers is if they have to do all this administrative extras.
Is that a question?
I didn't hear a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. And looks like last on the list, Representative Sexton.
Good afternoon. I guess this is for Mr. Wyckoff. You just mentioned the industry should plan for 5%. So coming out of the pipeline industry, I'm trying to understand how you would plan to take your maintenance program and reduce it to meet that 5% based on somebody who has no idea what you're doing as far as your long-term infrastructure plan is, and you're basically telling them, well, you're only going to be limited to 5%. And I think about the safety impacts of letting poles get older and collapse and things like that. So that seemed very arbitrary to me. Explain to me how that relates to infrastructure redevelopment and maintaining the infrastructure we have.
Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff.
Chair Ickham, Representative. So I did not say that they should plan to only have 5% increases and not do important things that wouldn't be covered by that 5%. What I meant is they should plan their cadence of coming in for rate cases, knowing that the 5% was the interim they would get.
Representative Sexton. Thank you. Mr. Bull.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's also important to know that since the interim rate statute went into effect back in, I think someone said 1982, we've also added other mechanisms for utilities to recover costs in between rate cases, such as rider that we've been talking about, rider recovery. We have cost true-ups within rate cases. We have deferred accounting. That all of that is used to manage costs in addition to the going through rate cases. Those things also have so many of the infrastructure costs that a utility is facing will first go through a rider process. So rather than through interim rates or a rate case, so those get recovered through a rider outside of a rate case, and then when they file a rate case, they get folded into the rate case. So there are a lot of mechanisms now that weren't available back in 1982 when the interim rate statute went into effect. And I think because this we have this patchwork of cost recovery mechanisms that this is a good time to start talking about is interim rates, the way it's currently structured, is it providing the benefit that it needs to. We don't need to rely on it entirely the way we did back in 1982 when it started. I also wanted to flag multi-year rate plans. Mr. Lippman brought up multi-year rate plans. We implemented the first multi-year rate plan back in 2013, a couple of years after the bill passed. So we've not been sitting on our hands. That's another mechanism to manage the stability of rates and revenues for utilities as well.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Mr. Representative Sexton.
Mr. Bull, thank you for testifying on behalf in favor of my bill to keep riders out there.
I think that's leading the witness there.
Not seeing any further questions, maybe I'll turn to the bill author for final comments.
Padamayaye, thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to say padamayaye to everybody for allowing me to bring this forward. Great conversations, and I look forward to more work on this. Padamaya, thank you.
And with that, the bill is laid over. Next on our agenda, we have House File 4122, Representative Hollins. And Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move that House File 4122 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Great. And it looks like there is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to discuss it.
Yes, please.
Would you like to move House?
Yes, I would like to move that.
The DE3. Any discussion on the DE3? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. This bill, as amended, is the result of the Thermal Energy Network Deployment Work Group, as well as months of negotiation with a broad array of stakeholders. Just in case folks are confused about it, thermal energy networks are projects that provide heating and cooling to multiple buildings connected via underground piping that contains fluids that exchange thermal energy from the earth, underground, or surface water, wastewater, or other heat sources. This bill is pretty simple as amended. It allows public utilities to build thermal energy networks if they so choose and to rate recover for those builds. Thermal energy networks are, per the bill, are subject to the same PUC oversight as electric and natural gas services, ensuring that consumer protection remains strong. And I did want to make one quick note. I believe it's at 2.18. In the cost recovery section, that may will be changed to a must. It just didn't quite make it into the amendment. And with that, I'll turn it over to testifiers.
Super. Let's see. There we go. First on the list, we have Aurora Vatran with 100% campaign. Welcome to committee, Ms. Vatran. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Acomb, Chair Spadzinski, members, my name is Aurora Vatran, and I'm the Legislative Director for 100%. I am excited to testify in support of this bill today, which would create the next step in Minnesota's leadership on thermal energy networks by allowing utilities to provide thermal energy service to their ratepayers. I want to thank our authors for their thoughtful work on this policy, the members of the PUC Deployment Work Group, which is where this bill started. And finally, I want to thank our labor and utility partners for all of the time and expertise they gave us to get this policy in a form that worked for everyone. This relatively simple bill has been years in the making. Minnesota's leadership on thermal energy networks began in 2021 with the passage of the Bipartisan Natural Gas Innovation Act, amended later to allow for more TENS pilots. Since then, we've passed a number of bills to advance TENS, and many other states are doing the same. Both the Trump and Biden administrations have made meaningful investments in thermal energy networks. Their popularity is growing across geographic and party. Thermal energy networks are an innovative technology that Minnesota should continue to advance. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Jamie Fitzke with CenterPoint Energy. Welcome back to committee, Ms. Fitzke. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Acomb, members of the committee. My name is Jamie Fitzke, Director of Government Affairs for CenterPoint Energy. I'd like to just first open by simply saying that I might say the words network geothermal or TENS, which is an acronym, so my apologies if I interchange them. And I'm going to give a quick brief history of how we got here. As Aurora mentioned, the Natural Gas Innovation Act, or NGIA for short, a bipartisan bill that was passed in 2021, established the opportunity for natural gas utilities to invest in pilots. Some of the neat things that we expect from our NGIA plan are deep energy retrofits, renewable natural gas, and thermal energy networks, or TENs. What's innovative about TENS is it would establish one of the first in extreme cold climate like ours. So we understand that there's a lot of excitement and anticipation in these systems. We expect to learn a lot from this first-of-a-kind pilot for CenterPoint Energy. We're being very intentional in the engagement, as it's important to have community and customer support in a pilot. We're very planful with this. It's important to have a site selected that will lead to a successful deployment. And then we are in the early stages of this pilot, and it will take a number of years to fully implement. CenterPoint Energy is Minnesota's largest natural gas utility, and we provide safe, reliable, and affordable heating that, and this cannot be jeopardized. For instance, this winter, we had three separate times where we were below negative 20 for multiple days straight. Nobody lost heat, which is important to note. Our natural gas system is built to handle extreme cold and have done so for over a century in Minnesota. We take a lot of pride in this. What we don't have is experience in TENS yet, which will be more complicated than a traditional general geothermal system, given that these are network systems and will be across a diverse customer base. But we're excited to know what we end up learning from these pilots. The DE reflects a substantial modification from the introduced language. This was achieved through multiple iterations and conversations, and we are extremely appreciative and recognize that these conversations were important in landing here. We appreciate that this bill is forward-looking as it addresses TENS constructed outside of Natural Gas Innovation Act pilots. There are a lot of unknowns, and instead of making what could be a costly or wrong assumption, there was a conscious decision to reassess what the intent is, and recognizing that there is a ton of excitement about TENS, but also that these will be complicated, especially navigating customer needs and how TENS will be implemented, both from a physical structure and also policy. These are answers that we do not have right now and won't have for a number of years, but are really looking forward to seeing what our pilots can achieve. The DE reflects intent by allowing a natural gas utility the ability to offer a TENS. And this includes Public Utility Commission, or PUC, oversight on cost recovery and all the protections and programs available to our current customers. We sincerely appreciate the excitement of TENS and that other stakeholders listened to our concerns and collaborated with us to find this language. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Fiske. And last on our list of testifiers, Kevin Prentiss with LIUNA. Welcome to committee, Mr. Prentiss. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Akam, Chair Swazitsky, and committee members. Kevin Prentiss on behalf of LIUNA, Minnesota, North Dakota. As you know, we represent 14,000 construction laborers across Minnesota and North Dakota. Happy to be here today to testify in support of the bill. A lot of hard work has gone into it, a lot of sort of wrestling over language and really trying to understand what's the thing that makes sense to do now, given, as Ms. Fiske said, there's a lot we still don't know about the potential for geothermal. I think for our perspective, besides being another sort of like potentially I think effective and efficient energy source and a low to no carbon energy source. The nice thing about geothermal is it uses a lot of the same skills as gas utility infrastructure and water infrastructure. And so looking at laborers and operating engineers, plumbers and pipe fitters, sheet metal workers and electricians. And so there's a lot of opportunities in this. There's also a lot we don't know, and we're hoping for advancements in drilling techniques that could really make this much more cost effective. That's the big issue in geothermal is how much does it cost and how long does it take to put in a well? And right now, there's only a certain number of places that are economical. That could change a lot and we've seen amazing advancements in drilling technology now all over the country. And so it is certainly feasible that we could want to move faster on this. And this gives the utilities and the commission the opportunity to move faster if it makes sense. And I would just say, you know, to close, we had an event on Friday. We were introducing a lot of energy and data construction owners, Xcel and CenterPoint, distribution co-ops, fuel producers, clean energy companies, two union contractors. We had 50 union contractors in the room. One of those owners was Darcy Solutions, which does geothermal. Not a lot of people have heard of them. Once the contractors heard the pitch, we had more demand for Darcy than almost any of the other companies there. So we had, a dozen different water sewer contractors. contractors that were like, hey, can I get a meeting with those people? I am interested. I own this equipment. I do very similar work. There's a lot of enthusiasm here. And what this bill does is it opens up that pathway for those businesses to say, yes, you should explore geothermal. You should see whether you could fit in. So I hope the bill passes, and thanks for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and the plug for Darcy. I think they do great work. Let's see. There's no other testifiers, so turn it back to committee members. Are there any questions or comments? I will say I think really excited about the bill and the potential. I think there's a lot of lot to be learned about TENS, and so looking forward to that. Great. Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this forward. So I'm just really excited about this bill. I think that a lot of people in my community, I live in Minneapolis, that have been wanting to see more thermal energy networks, and so just I think this is a really important step that we're taking, and we'd be a leader in the country in taking this step, so I just really appreciate your leadership on this. Thank you.
Agreed. Ditto with that. Seeing no other questions or comments, any closing remarks, Representative Hollins?
Thank you, Chair Akam, Chair Swazinski, members. Thank you to my testifiers. I cannot emphasize how long of a path this has been and how difficult and challenging it has been, and there have been so many iterations of this bill. I know that not everybody is going to be satisfied with this compromise language, but I will say it is a huge step forward to put into statute that utilities are allowed to build these TENS and are allowed to rate recover. That is something that, to the best of my knowledge, is unique in Minnesota, and so it really would be a huge step forward. We know that decarbonizing heating and cooling is one of the biggest challenges that we have in the clean energy transition, and this bill would create a foundation for utilities to incorporate TENS into their resource plans. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the bill is laid over. And we will move on to our final bill today, House File 4377, with Representative Jones. And Representative Jones, would you like to go ahead and move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 4377.
Great. And looks like there's an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that we'd like to discuss. Would you like to move?
I move the amendment.
A2. Great. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. With that, why don't you go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Yes, good afternoon, co-chairs Akam and Swazinski and members of the committee. I bring to you a common sense bill that fixes a gap in our current statutes. In our state, for large energy projects, we require a certificate of need. We do that because large energy projects can have significant and or negative externalities in our local communities and statewide. So besides the environmental assessments and reviews, we make sure that there's an actual need for the infrastructure. This bill supports that purpose by requiring that the Certificate of Need applicants for oil pipelines assess reasonable criteria to forecast the demand for oil in Minnesota and in our immediate neighboring states that we most readily trade with. The bill proposes criteria including population change, technology adoption, modes of travel, impacts of commodity prices, among others, to forecast oil demand. Minnesota has zero fossil fuels in our state. Unlike states like North Dakota, our state coffers do not benefit at all from extraction of oil from the ground. We are a pass-through and consumption state. Minnesota and Minnesotans take on a lot of risk to our environment and health and safety as a pass-through state for oil pipelines crossing from Canada and the Dakotas to refineries and export terminals. If we are going to do that, we need to make sure that there is a true benefit and or need for our people in the way of a future demand for oil. Oil pipelines are serious infrastructure, which historically are built and are in use for decades. However, we know that times are changing. The growth of EVs is exponential because they're simpler to run and have lower operational costs. I actually know this because I got the data in Transportation Committee, and I was like, this seems to be exponential. I actually graphed it and ran a regression model. It is actually exponential growth. And among other things, in terms of technology changes, places that heat with fuel oil and propane are quickly switching to electric heat pumps because the operational costs are lower. I even had a conversation last year with Representative Olson, who raved about his new electric lawnmower being quieter, cleaner, and not having to deal with getting fuel from the gas station. And we must also address the elephant in the room. The Trump administration's poorly considered war with Iran has once again shown the volatility of oil as an energy source. But let's be clear. This bill does not ban or deny any oil pipeline in Minnesota. Instead, it asks the prudent question on behalf of Minnesotans. Is there sufficient and justifiable demand for a new oil pipeline? I thank you for the consideration of this bill and welcome my testifiers and stand for questions.
Great. Looks like there's a couple testifiers on the list. First up is Andy Pearson with CURE. Welcome to committee, Mr. Pearson. Please go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Chairs Akam and Swiedzinski and Representative Jones and committee members. My name is Andy Pearson, and I'm a senior organizer with CURE. CURE is a rurally based nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and restoring resilient communities and landscapes by harnessing the power of people who care. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in strong support of House File 4377. In Minnesota, large oil pipelines are required to obtain a certificate of need from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission as part of the permitting process. This requires the company to prove that the infrastructure is a public good, in part by showing that there will be demand for the product over the next 15 years. Who must be considered in these demand forecasts has been at the heart of recent pipeline discussions. Oil companies have argued that these forecasts can be based on demand from other oil companies, even those halfway around the world. Public interest groups and Minnesota's own Department of Commerce, on the other hand, have encouraged consideration of ultimate consumer demand in our region, or what the users of end products like gasoline are expected to need. The absence of a clear definition has resulted in litigation, controversy, and expense. House File 4377 provides common sense clarification about how the PUC should evaluate demand. The bill establishes that a demand forecast must include projected consumption of gasoline and other petroleum products in Minnesota and neighboring states, anticipated policy and market changes, and regional population and economic growth trends. This ensures that Minnesota doesn't take on the economic and environmental risks of oil pipeline infrastructure that is unjustified. It's time to modernize energy planning process so that the infrastructure that is built reflects what Minnesotans and the region truly need. And for these reasons, CURE urges you to support House File 4377. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. And next on the list, we have Ben Olson with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Thank you for joining us in committee today. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Swiedzinski, members of the committee, Representative Jones. My name is Ben Olson. I'm Legislative Director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We support House File 4377. This is a common sense clarification to Minnesota's Certificate of Need statute for large petroleum pipelines. It amends the statute to specify that existing energy demand forecast requirements must relate to demand from the ultimate end consumers of refined petroleum products, those of us that use those products. This is an important clarification because under the current law, some companies have leveraged the ambiguity to cater to demands of their business partners rather than real-world public need. This ambiguity has also led to confusion and litigation between companies, advocates, and regulators. In the last large petroleum pipeline application for a certificate of need proceeding at the Public Utilities Commission, a sitting commissioner said, and I quote, "We need to clarify the law to focus squarely and thoroughly on the demand for refined products," end quote. This bill does that. This is especially timely as we see stagnating global oil demand. The risk of overbuilding the system is real as oil companies compete for the remaining market. And gasoline demand has peaked before 2005 in Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois. Yet, as our state's demand for oil has decreased, the amount of oil moving through it has increased. Without updating our laws to calibrate our energy planning processes to real-world need, we expose our land and water to unnecessary risk from these projects. We also open up Minnesota landowners to unnecessary eminent domain property seizures by international energy conglomerates. Lastly, this clarification aligns the energy demand forecast with how the Public Utilities Commission already applies the certificate of need to electricity generating facilities and transmission lines. Please support the common sense clarification offered in House File 4377. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Seeing no further testifiers, any questions or comments from committee members? It looks like Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jones, thanks for bringing this bill. Am I right in saying, I'm trying to distill it down, basically what you're saying is make sure we're taking into account reality?
Representative Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Akam, that is correct.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft.
Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Kraft.
We know you have a lot going on.
Yes. I haven't had a lot of sleep lately.
Yeah. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not even going to go, Representative Jones.
Yeah.
Well, I like reality, so let's do this. Thank you.
Next on the list, Representative Sexton.
This truly baffles me as a former pipeline professional. You know, we call it Public Utility Commission, yet can you point out any pipeline that is owned by a public utility?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sexton for the question. So we have a certificate of need process that already applies to pipelines. And so what this bill is doing is helping to clarify, provide some greater clarity for that certificate of need process.
Representative Sexton.
Okay. A couple things that I'm going to change questions in a little bit here. So in the testimony earlier, it mentioned that the pipeline companies are not paying taxes. Well, that's untrue. They pay a lot of property taxes along the right of way. So a lot of various counties and such like that benefit from that tax base coming through and appreciate it. The other thing that I just heard was eminent domain is used by the pipeline companies, which is absolutely untrue. Eminent domain is not allowed by private pipeline companies. Having been on the right of way many times, we worked with landowners to fit the pipeline to their needs to work around their properties, and believe me, we wrote big checks. So just want to point that out. The other thing is, you know, we're talking about a drop of oil that may originate in northern Alberta, pass through Minnesota, through Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri, Cushing, Oklahoma, and end up down in Houston, Texas, be refined, and piped all the way up to Boston as a refined product. It seems to me there's something called the Commerce Clause out there because these are interstate pipelines in many cases. So I'm trying to figure out how we're trying to island off Minnesota and not realize that this is, you're right, a pass-through, but it supports U.S. commerce and Canadian commerce. We flow oil into the U.S. because it's easier and safer and then push it back to parts of Canada. From Canada. So, again, I'm truly baffled by this bill that just is going to add costs to everybody. So, I don't know that it's going to benefit anything. So, I just don't know where to go with it. I don't recommend a yes vote from my side of the aisle.
Representative Jones, did you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sexton for those comments. So the bill does apply not only to Minnesota and in terms of looking at the forecasting for needs, not only Minnesota, but the surrounding states. So it is not in violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. And the reason for that is because we needed to, when we're thinking about what are the benefits to Minnesotans, we need to be able to create what is the closed system? Because, yes, as you were saying, a drop of oil can go elsewhere and at the end of the day be benefiting someone in Germany or India. And we need to be able to draw the system boundary somewhere. And I think you have a technical mind as well. And it's like drawing system boundaries is important. So that's where we landed on this. And I'm happy to continue that conversation if that's not quite the right system boundary. But at the end of the day, if we're going to be a pass-through state and we're going to be taking on some risk, we need to make sure that there is benefit to Minnesotans, and we are understanding that need here, and that we're not basing our policy on the needs of people in India or Germany or Boston even.
Representative Igo, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really, I got to give credit to Representative Sexton. He kind of took my question, the Commerce Clause stuff. Just sounds like you've done your research. I would encourage you to really go deeper on that. I know Mr. Eliff knows I've worked on bills with him in the past where Commerce Clause stuff has come up and it can get really messy and very intricate. So I think through my interpretation of it, I think it's operating in a gray space that could bring a lot of legal charges to it that could result in some bad implications for the state of Minnesota. So that's just the concern I see with it right now.
Not seeing a question. Next, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jones, you know, some of the early thoughts on green energy was conversations of increasing the cost of fossil fuels. I mean, it was something that was commonly talked about in like the, you know, around 2009. And actually in 2009, the cost of gasoline was $1.85, and by 2012 was $3.59. How do you think this will affect the cost of fossil fuel? And do you think that's a goal?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for the question. So we already have a certificate of need process. This is part of a clarification to that process. We know that there is no fiscal note to it, so it is really just adding to the body of information that is evaluated during that certificate of need process.
Representative Murphy?
Could this ban the pipeline outright? And would there be added costs from doing that with those approvals?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Murphy. As I said in my original testimony, this does not ban any new oil pipelines. If this suddenly we say that, so EVs fail completely and we're all just, you know, we're going to be driving ICE vehicles for the rest of time, then there is a clear demand. And so then there would be a need for continued oil pipelines.
Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you. And this is not for new certificate of need. You're saying it's only for if you're going to re-up it or add anything to it.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Murphy. Correct. This is looking forward. This is everything else is grandfathered.
Yeah. So the only thing I'll comment on that is as we're growing, you know, and we need to move more, this is one of those complications that will add cost. And so that'd be my point. Thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a point in response to what Representative Murphy was just saying. The idea here is not to say it's a bigger pipeline or a smaller pipeline. It's to say it's a right-sized pipeline. If the growth is in there, then that would show that. But it's to say it's right-sized. And with a right-sized pipeline, it would be the minimum cost. So I actually think what this is a cost-saving measure, so we're not putting in additional infrastructure that's not necessary.
See no question, but there looks like there's a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kraft. Just expanding on that, we know that a lot of times that infrastructure, especially energy infrastructure, after it is used, it is then left and abandoned. And then a lot of times that becomes the public's responsibility to somehow mitigate and deal with. And so kind of to Representative Kraft's point is, you know, if we don't see that there is a demand in the future for this oil, then we shouldn't be putting infrastructure that often, too often, the public gets saddled with cleaning up the messes.
Representative Sexton. And then we'll do
it. Just as comments were made earlier, you know, we have this thing in the United States called capitalism. And when a pipeline company is putting in a pipeline at $5 or $6 million a mile, they do a really good job of right sizing the pipeline for their customer future, because it's very hard to flow like air and oil through a pipeline. So you've got to get it the right size to maintain the demand, because there's not that much storage on the other end. It's going right to the refinery, going right to a refined product, and continuing the pipeline right down for our fuel tanks. So they do a fantastic job with capitalism of right-sizing the pipeline.
And Representative Hollins, are you thinking? It's okay. You can think.
I tried.
Do you have a question? Yeah. No? Okay. All right. If you change your mind in something, yeah, okay. Then Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Swazinski. And, you know, this is just a general, you know, this is a very interesting conversation, and, you know, it was brought up that does this bill, you know, reflect reality? Well, the reality is that, you know, the commodities we produce domestically. So this isn't talking just what we're producing in Minnesota. This isn't just producing in a part of our state, but we live in an international market when it comes to oil, when it comes to grain, when it comes to all the products that we create, whether it's the things built in 3M or the things built in Alberta. You know, we all play a part in an economy, if it's a world economy, a global economy, or a regional economy. And by really seeking ways, I view this as, you know, if you go back in time and you look at history and you look at the battle between the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts, and you had a pinch, and you had the Vanderbilts trying to raise the cost of transportation when it came to oil and moving oil throughout the United States, and was pinching Standard Oil. And Mr. Rockefeller looked around his factory and saw pipes moving product from one end of the factory to the next. And he had the idea of saying, well, maybe we should begin the process of running pipes across the country rather than running it on rail. And if I was to ever say this would be potentially a pro-railroad bill, that's what this bill does. Because if we're not going to move product on an international market in the most efficient way possible, which is through pipe, then we're going to do it in other ways. We'll do it in straight lines on two rails running through highly populated areas that are used to international trade. They'll go to ports, they'll go to refineries on rail that will cost, ultimately, if we're worried about costs, we've heard a couple bills today, if we're worried about costs, transportation, by and large, when it comes to bulky products, is one of the highest cost derivatives that get added to the end product. And if our goal is to drive the cost of things up, this is a great bill to do it. You know, if we want to protect, we're talking about abandoned pipelines and the cleanup. Well, we have pipelines in southwest Minnesota that are being abandoned because government is forcing them to not be used, so they won't be allowed to be fixed or upgraded. And that's causing higher fuel prices to customers in my district. And so if we want to really advocate for that, we need not fear the most efficient quality way to transport goods from an international perspective. We like to focus in, we want to, you know, say, well, how does it affect us? Well, if that's all we're concerned about, you know, then no one will trade with us. You know, we've heard a lot about tariff. We've heard a lot about what do those things do. And I would really think that we should start thinking long term, because whenever you're talking about tariffs, whenever you're talking about regulatory oversight, whenever you're talking about expanding or right-sizing pipe and, you know, where the economy is, where it's going to be, we need to think long and hard about things that we don't necessarily know yet. And I think as we're discussing issues like this, it's fun to think and kind of build a little wall, build a little dome around our ideas and protect what we think is right. But at the end of the day, we play a big part or a little part when it comes to an international economy. And I think this closes Minnesota off when it comes to development. This closes Minnesota off to economic vitality. And it closes Minnesota off to playing a good part in international trade.
Did you want to respond to that, Representative Jones?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things that I heard in there. There was a piece around fear, and what I'm sensing here is like there's a fear of information. What this bill does is it provides additional information for the certificate of need. And I ask, why is that a bad thing? Representative or Co-Chair Swazinski also mentioned we need to think long term. That's exactly what this bill does. It's looking 15 years into the future. It asks what policies are on the books. I think, you know, one of these things in here is vehicle miles traveled. We have a goal of the state has a statewide goal of reducing VMT by 20% per capita. We need to be taking that into account for the future of the demand of oil in our state. So that is just one example of the criteria in this bill that helps inform the certificate, better inform the certificate of need process.
And it appears that Representative Hollins does have a question after all. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Akam. I'm sorry, I'm a little under the weather. My brain is not working as fast as it should be.
You're doing great.
So first of all, thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. And I think your statements right there were kind of what I was trying to get at, which is this is but one piece of information that adds to the conversation about the certificate of need. And it's been my experience that fossil fuel companies are pretty good at getting what they want and finding ways to make the numbers work for them. I think looking 15 years into the future is a perfectly reasonable timeline to look at when building a pipeline. And I actually kind of doubt that they would have a problem with finding some sort of justification that there is a need for building those pipelines in this situation. I think it's really interesting that we're hearing opposition to this when I think that it would be pretty reasonable. I think it's a pretty reasonable request to ask companies how they see this moving forward. I mean, this is massive infrastructure that is stuck in our grounds for 60 years and that we often deal with the cleanup and removal of. And so it's reasonable to say in 15 years, is this still going to be necessary? So I just want to thank you for bringing it forward. I don't think this is going too far. I think it's especially, I think it's pretty moderate, frankly. And to your point, I think it is forward thinking, right? I mean, what we're doing now is not necessarily forward thinking. And what we need to do is consider, I mean, right, we know that peak production or use of fossil fuels in Minnesota was in 2017. So are we being forward thinking or are we not? And, you know, at some point, fossil fuel companies are going to have to do that. Just to make money, because to Representative Sexton's point, we live in capitalism. And at some point, they're going to say this doesn't make any sense anymore. They're already doing it. They're pivoting to making plastics instead of doing fossil fuel crude oil, right? I mean, they find a way to get money. You guys don't have to worry about that. They are going to find a way. So I think this is a really reasonable request, and I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
And we're going to turn it over to Representative Jones for closing comments.
Thank you all for this really interesting discussion, and I look forward to working further on it towards the end of session.
Great. And with that, the bill is laid over, and that concludes our agenda for today. So we'll see you all back here on Thursday. All right.